Hi guys, I'm Andrew Davidson with AsPerMyAbility.com. I'd like to start this episode off by opening my door and inviting you into my personal space. What do you say, huh? Let's have a brief chin wag, just you and me. Excellent. I'll put on the kettle. Okay, so I live alone. However, I have two cats that live with me, although an outsider could easily argue that I am, in fact, living with them, taking up their space, breathing their air, kicking them out of their spot on the bed, playing music during their important mid-afternoon siestas. Anyway, like I was saying, I have two girls. My first cat is quite old and an absolute fireball mess of cranky and attitude, or cranktitude. Pop, pop. Her name is Desiree Bennington. When I got her, another lifetime ago, I lived with a roommate, an actual human one. We debated long and hard over what name should be given to the new kitten. Me, being the Stephen King dork that I am, wanted to name her Church after the cat from Pet Sematary. My nerdness was met with instant disgust and disapproval. My roommate had some weird obsession with pets that have painfully dull human names. A dog named Steve. A cat named Roberta. A parrot named Roger. Actually, that one is kind of funny. When it came to pet names, he and I were like yin and yang. I wanted something silly, he wanted something boring. As the story goes, we spent day after day giving each other suggestions, and heaven help me, we could not agree on anything. So we decided to handle it the good old-fashioned way like men. Rock, paper, scissors. Best out of three. The agreed-upon stipulation went like this. The winner would be allowed to choose any name for the kitten, and as a consolation prize, the loser would be allowed to choose the kitten's last name. Now, considering this super massively important throwdown occurred another lifetime ago, I cannot remember how each reveal played out, but when the dust settled and my blood pressure returned to normal, I was left with the prestigious honor of finding a last name for the new kitty. My roommate selected the name Desiree because it was the name of some stripper he was in love with, or porn star, or I don't know, something like that. Now, I wouldn't consider myself a die-hard fan of Linkin Park. However, at the time of this story, I was listening to and enjoying my Best of Linkin Park playlist. I found the group's lead singer, Chester Bennington, RIP, quite talented. He could sing. He could harmonize. He could scream. I dug it. So a decree was made. The new cat would be forever named Desiree Bennington. Yeah, looking back, I thank God I wasn't able to name her Church or any other of those silly, stupid names. I can't quite explain it, but I cannot imagine an alternate world where she is named anything else. Losing to my roommate at Rock, Paper, Scissors was one of the best things to happen to me. Sometimes the sting of defeat is the best thing. Life is funny like that. Now, for my second cat, I was living alone. Again, I wanted to name her something quirky. To be honest, I have absolutely 0.0 memory of how I became dead set on my cat name formula, but I decided that her first name had to be board game related, and because I'm a history buff, duh, the last name had to be related to someone I admire from history. For her first name, I eventually settled on Dixit. Okay, first, I do love the game. Second, Dixit just sounds cool. It's French. And finally, Dixit provides just the right amount of quirky without falling completely into the deep end. Assigning her last name proved to be surprisingly easy, actually. Her name is, and continues to be, Dixit Doolittle, after one of my personal war heroes. James Harold Doolittle. James, who often went by Jimmy Doolittle was born in Alameda, California, just a few years shy of the oncoming 20th century in 1896. While born in California, Jimmy Doolittle spent most of his youth not far from Russian soil in Nome, Alaska. Growing up, Jimmy enjoyed boxing, establishing the stereotype by which all fraternity guys for the rest of time would be weighed and measured while attending college at the University of Berkeley, California, and falling helplessly, hopelessly in love with aviation. By April of 1917, when American forces entered the European bloodbath known as the Great War, Doolittle was 21 years old and already a formidable pilot, flight leader, and gunnery instructor. During the war, he stayed in America by performing his war service as a flight instructor. A few short years later, and Doolittle is well-respected as a pilot and instructor, receiving his doctorate from MIT in advanced engineering and a commissioned major in the Air Reserve Corps. During the Great Depression, Doolittle enjoyed working on and advancing aeronautical technology. The man couldn't have wished for anything more, I kid you not. He was educated, married to his longtime sweetheart, and making a decent living doing the one thing he loves. He was living a textbook American dream. But as Robert Frost once wrote, nothing gold can stay. Unfortunately, on December 7th, 1941, Doolittle's easygoing, picture-perfect life would come to a screeching halt. On that date, a date that will live in infamy, the Empire of Japan led a surprise attack at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Not only did the attack destroy American public opinion of laissez-faire, but it brought Doolittle to the war. Keeping with the American "you hit us, we hit you back" tradition, General H.H. Arnold was quickly approved by the powers that be to begin planning America's retaliation of shock and awe against the Empire of Japan. Doolittle volunteered to help plan, organize, and even lead the attack. Even though Doolittle stood at a meager 5'6", General Arnold saw a giant with the guts of a man and the heart of a hero. Arnold immediately approved, and Doolittle went to work. Directed by Michael Bay, Pearl Harbor stars Ben Affleck, Josh Hartnett, and Kate Beckinsale. Released in 2001, and with a runtime just over 3 hours, Pearl Harbor contains 35 minutes of history and about 2 hours and 40 minutes of fictional character development, backstory, and strengthening the narrative's love triangle. As a cinematic experience, Pearl Harbor is, well, it's as good as any other historical fiction film, I guess. Sadly, the film's historical accuracy is shoved out of the back seat to make room for its central romantic narrative thread. Pearl Harbor illustrates that in order to fall deeply, madly in love, one must risk being altruistic, vulnerable, and to live every day with reckless abandon. Romance always comes at a price. The reason, the only reason, I'm mentioning Pearl Harbor in this episode is to draw your attention to the film's climactic third act. While the film's ending is less than 2% accurate, it does show Jimmy Doolittle at his finest hour. On April 18th, 1942, Doolittle executed his plan, which is now commonly referred to as the Doolittle Raid. The U.S. Navy aircraft carrier USS Hornet would escort 16 modified B-25 B Michelle bombers holding 5 crew members per ship off the coast of Japan. The B-25s would depart the Hornet, travel without a single fighter escort, and bomb the crud out of selected military and industrial targets. The B-25s were heavily modified to lighten the bombers. The original plan outlined that after dropping their payload, the B-25s would return to the Hornet. However, during training, problems arose. While the pilots found takeoff relatively easy, landing an enormous bomber on a moving carrier flight deck was extremely difficult, near impossible. The mission required revision. Doolittle decided that after the aircraft had dropped their bombs, they would head for unoccupied China or the Soviet city of Vladivostok. And just like that, the raid became a suicide mission. Now, Vladivostok was a closer and more feasible target. Unfortunately, during that time, the city's proximity was surrounded by Japanese forces. Also, negotiations with the USSR to authorize American planes to land on Soviet territory, well, were unsuccessful. As if that wasn't enough, a significant portion of eastern China had been conquered and occupied by the Empire of Japan. Due to the amended mission plan, Doolittle could not guarantee safety for any of his men. He released the crew from being forced onto a mission in which they most likely would not survive. But Doolittle had one final card to play. He asked for volunteers. Yep, that's right. Every single man that participated in the Doolittle raid were made fully aware of the danger and peril, and despite everything, willingly volunteered to fly alongside Jimmy Doolittle. Around 3 a.m. on the morning of April 18th, American radar operators detected a Japanese patrol boat located outside of its patrol zone. About 4 hours later, a different patrol boat appeared 20,000 yards from the Hornet. The patrol boat sent a communication to the Japanese military, and just like that, their position would attract every Japanese vessel in the Pacific. Doolittle had hoped to launch his aircraft at a distance of 400 miles from Japan. However, as another Japanese vessel arrived, Doolittle made the decision to launch. The USS Hornet was 10 hours and 820 miles away from the expected launch point. Within an hour, all bombers were airborne. Doolittle and his rowdy Devil's Brigade approached Tokyo from the north, flying as low as the terrain would permit. As they neared their targets, the aircraft climbed to a bombing altitude of 1,200 feet, released their bombs, then dove to treetop level and flew west over the outskirts of the city. The bombers turned southbound for the East China Sea. While some of the bombs fell within proximity, the raid inflicted nominal damage. The targets that were hit were pretty damaged, but not destroyed. Due to the early departure, forcing the bombers to fly longer than anticipated, fuel began to run dangerously low. It was imperative that the crew and their craft fly as far inland as possible to avoid crashing or landing in occupied Chinese territory. If that were to happen, the crew would be out of the pan and into the fire. As Japan opted out of signing the Geneva Convention, which established international standards for humanitarian treatment in war, the pilot and crew were caught. Their best possible outcome is that they would be simply and promptly shot. Man, I love the history of Japan. Its culture, traditions, the food, the whole nine yards. Maybe someday I will get a chance to travel to the House of the Rising Sun. I would absolutely love to visit and explore the beautiful coastline. So, no offense, but during World War II, Japanese forces, y'all were a bunch of sadistic douche buckets. The horrific cries and sound of breaking bones were not gruesome enough to turn a single head in disgust. Unlike the German forces in the Eastern Theater, the physiological and psychological torment of POWs by Japanese forces were so commonplace that torture was practically destigmatized. Now, Doolittle and his crew managed to land safely in friendly territory. The locals assisted the crew by contacting the Chinese government and authorities. The government alerted residents in the area to be on the lookout for crashed planes or makeshift boats along the coastline. By April 20th, 2 days later, four additional crews had been located. Only three of the 16 crews failed to reach safety. Due to fuel depletion, one plane crashed near Vladivostok, where the surviving crew members were forced into a Soviet internment camp for a year before managing to escape. The other two crews were captured by Japanese forces in China, one near the coast, the other near Lake Poyang. The crews were imprisoned and routinely tortured. The Chinese government made numerous attempts to buy the captured Americans' freedom, but all attempts were unsuccessful. Only four individuals managed to survive as POWs until the end of the war and their eventual release. Three crew members were eventually executed by Japanese forces, while the others died from diseases such as dysentery or from just malnourishment. There is a limited podcast series titled America's Forgotten Heroes. If interested, you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Each episode is excellent. It's polished and produced with accompanying soundtrack, voices, and sound effects. Furthermore, it is narrated by Bill Whittle, who has one of those unique voices that is engaging and yet relaxing at the same time. The second episode, Jimmy Doolittle Releases the Brakes, provides an entire hour's worth of specific events, timelines, perspectives, and details all regarding the Doolittle Raid. The episode concludes by delineating the significance and historical impact of the 1942 raid on Tokyo. It ends with these words. So, was it worth it? What, in the end, had the Doolittle Raid accomplished other than some minor damage to the city of Tokyo? Well, the effect it had on the morale of the American people was immeasurable. The utter humiliation of what had seemed to be an unstoppable, invincible enemy steamroller. Now the Japanese knew the shame and horror and dismay that America had experienced at the hands of the Japanese on that Sunday morning in Pearl Harbor. When he heard of the news of the bombing of Tokyo, Japanese Admiral Yamamoto became physically ill. Yamamoto's shame, the Americans had just missed the Imperial Palace, was so intense that he was not going to wait for repairs and resupply. He would force the American fleet to Midway and destroy it with the four carriers he had on hand, rather than wait for the knockout punch of his two strongest flat tops. Had the Doolittle Raid not happened, and the Japanese had brought six carriers instead of four, the battle would have been almost entirely different and cost the Americans the Hornet and the Enterprise in addition to the Yorktown. But the Doolittle Raid did happen. Yamamoto had been shamed into attacking without his full force, which was four Japanese carriers and not six, and that would face the three American flat tops, and all four Japanese carriers would go down as a result of the furious 6 minutes of Wade McCluskey's squadron of dive bombers, crippling the Japanese Navy and turning the tide of the war. In honor and remembrance, a Doolittle Raiders exhibit is located at the National Museum of the United States Air Force. James Doolittle continued to fly missions until the end of the war. For his bravery and continued dedication, he received the Medal of Honor from President Franklin D. Roosevelt. James Harold Doolittle died of a heart attack in 1993. He was 96 years old. While I understand that Memoir 44 is not a direct comparative to Doolittle's heroic raid, with the addition of two expansions, the Pacific Theater, which adds Japanese figures and scenarios, and New Flight Plan, that allows players control of the sky, it's as close as you're going to get. But hey, I'm getting ahead of myself. How about some stats first, eh? Released by Days of Wonder, Memoir 44 is a two-player, scenario-driven World War II war game. As most of you already know, there are about somewhere around 6.8 billion war games I could have focused on. I chose Memoir 44 due to its accessibility, meager learning curve, and duration. In Memoir 44, one player commands the Allied forces while the other operates the German. Or, depending on what expansions you purchase, you can play as the French Resistance or Empire of Japan. The game board is made up of hex spaces that receive a terrain tile according to the selected scenario. Now, unlike Axis and Allies, Memoir 44 zooms the camera in by focusing on the ground combat. First, the scenarios. All the scenarios represent historical battles during 1944. Players populate the board in a realistic and appropriate fashion. Sometimes you'll have tanks to march around because a group of tanks were actually positioned in that location. Other times, you'll have a whole host of boots on the ground taking cover in the forest because that's how the battle began. Second, the gameplay. This is the reason why I always recommend Memoir 44 to new gamers that want to dip their feet into combat games. And as I've already alluded to, it's the reason why it's featured in this podcast. The gameplay is incredibly simple. The game board is sectioned into three parts: left flank, right flank, and middle. On a player's turn, they play a card from their hand that allows them to activate a specific amount of units in a particular section. Any activated unit is allowed to move, attack, attack, and move, all depending on the type of unit and terrain. Combat damage is determined by the roll of some dice, the number of which is determined by the type of the unit, terrain, distance. When completed, the player discards their card and draws a new one. Now, there are special ability and reaction cards involved, but since I'm only providing an overview, I won't go into too much detail about those. Players continue taking turns until the scenario's objective condition is met. Third, the duration. Setup of the board can be a bit of a grind, but if both players work together, or if you set up the scenario beforehand, it's really not that bad. I have yet to play any of the mega map scenarios, but the ones in the base game usually run somewhere around the 1 hour mark, which is absolutely perfect for gamers looking to play a combat game without dedicating the next 12 hours to it. I've mentioned a few, but there are a ton of expansions for Memoir 44. Even an expansion that allows for team versus team play. I mean, how exciting is that? The expansions offer new scenarios, new game mechanics, and new terrain tiles. As a gamer, it's always an assurance knowing that if you love the base game and want more, there is more to be had. If you're somewhat new to the hobby, I highly, highly recommend giving Memoir 44 a try. It's the perfect game for when you're snowed in with your roommate and feel inspired by the heroic and tenacious spirit of Jimmy Doolittle and his crew. My name is Andrew Davidson. I hope I have given you something to think about.